please dial star 611 for assistance.
We get signal, main screen turn on. You're listening to the radio program about Hacker Spaces. This here little radio program about Hacker Spaces. Welcome to Talking Anthropology. I'm your host, Thomas Lonia, and today's episode is about European net politics. And my guest today is Andreas Krisch, the president from the Organization of European Digital Rights and also a member of the Working Group for Data Retention in Austria. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for inviting me.
Maybe you can introduce yourself, give us some background about you, where you came from, and how you came to work with these topics.
Well, I started, I think, about 10 years ago with my work on data protection, particularly here in Austria, when I dealt with RFIDs, these tiny radio frequency chips, for identifying objects, and I wondered why people are using this technology in a very privacy unfriendly way. And I started to investigate the topic and got in contact with data protection activists here in Austria, and that's more or less where everything started. And then in 2002 we felt that more and more legislation on net politics issues, on data protection and so on, is being decided in the European Union in Brussels, and that it would make sense to not only work on the local level, for example in Austria or others in Germany, in France and so on, but to join and to establish a European group working on these topics that are important to us on the European level. And so we founded in 2002 the European Digital Rights, and started to do our work there and to get in contact with the EU institutions and to engage in the European legislative process and to stand up for our rights there.
And what's your personal background? Do you come from a technical field, or are you a lawyer, or
Yeah, I studied information systems, so it's a mixed background of technology and organization and organizational things in companies and organizations and so on. And yeah, that needs a lot of analytical skills, I think, and that helps me very much also with my activities for European Digital Rights.
And so the topic of RFID was the one which really got you started into politics, when I got you right. So, and it's kind of funny, because it still is a kind of technology which makes people worry a lot about localization. But when you look at today, we have April 2011, and now every one of us carries mobile phones, and basically you can do much more than what you could have done with the RFID technology. So it kind of outdated and
No, not at all. It's not outdated, it's just not arrived. That's the problem. I started to investigate this topic in, I think it was 2002, when it was still researched at the MIT at the time, and before it was really released to the market and widely used. And nowadays it's being adopted not only in supply chain, but also in libraries, for example. They identify the books with RFIDs. Retailers use it to tag their products and to identify them at the checkout and so on. And recently I've been in Brussels at a big event at the European Commission, where the Commission and industry representatives signed a privacy impact assessment framework for RFID, which we negotiated the last 2 years in Brussels, because there were massive concerns about the privacy implications of deploying such technology. And I think it's accurate to say that industry is now deploying this technology into practice. So I was early to investigate in 2002 and had the opportunity, therefore, to be involved in the process, to be in the expert group at the European Commission, and to help develop this privacy-friendly approach that is now taken.
And what can one do with RFID technology? Especially what's not possible with mobile phones and other location-based systems?
Well, the core of this technology is to identify every single object. You give every object that you have, you give a unique ID, and based on this ID, you can basically do everything. You can use it for your stock keeping. You can use it to optimize your checkout and to speed up the checkout queue. But you can also use it to track people when they carry objects that are tagged with RFID tags. Everybody can go there and track the numbers that are passing by. And based on these numbers, you can do any profiling that you like, because there is no way for the people to protect themselves and to hinder you from reading these IDs. And they do not even know it, of course, because they are often not aware that there are RFID tags in these products. And that's a big privacy danger, because then you can do lots of marketing analysis, for example, by tracking if a pair of shoes comes by often or only seldom, or just came by once or however. So there are a lot of patterns that you can gain with that, and you can associate these patterns to natural persons, and therefore it's a privacy problem that needs to be solved.
I think the most popular example for RFID chips are European passports, if I'm not mistaken, or...
Yes, they are included in the passports, but these are relatively good, because they are protected by cryptography. But the weak point is, of course, that they store biometric data on it, and it doesn't really help to encrypt the data when every border control is able to read it and to decrypt it, because you never know what happens then with your data. You give the data to the border control, and it depends on the security mechanisms this country takes if your data is safe. And so probably they store it forever, probably they just check it against your physical presence and delete it afterwards, but you never know. And so you give away your biometric data to every country that you visit, and at every border control that you pass, you give away your data. And that's the big difference to the situation we had before. But for storage, I think these RFIDs are relatively safe, but still we need to be careful and protect our passports anyway.
Ah, that's a quite good example for this European level of legislative and also where data protection needs to take place. So let's talk about EDRI, the European Digital Rights Association, our organization. You are the president of this group. Can you tell us something about the goals of this organization and what it deals with?
Yes, our goal is to defend digital rights, as our name says, which means not only data protection, but also topics like net neutrality, for example. We are against web blocking. We think that there is more to the internet than just commerce, but there needs to be free spaces, there need to be open standards, for example. It needs to be accessible to all, and that's a broad set of topics that we want to cover, and our aim is to make ourselves heard in the European legislative process and to be present to promote these values that we stand for, and to make sure that they are considered in this process.
And maybe you can tell us something about the organization itself. Do you have members, or do you have any localization in European countries?
EPRI is an umbrella organization, so we are made up of organizations. We do not have individual members, and currently we have 28 member organizations from 18 European countries, where we define Europe as the area that is covered by the Council of Europe area member states, not only the European Union. So it's the broader sense of Europe, and we also have members outside of the European Union.
And can you name some of these member organizations that one can have an association to their local?
Member organizations are, for example, Bits of Freedoms in the Netherlands, Chaos Computer Club in Germany, in IRIS in France, La Quadrature du Net in France is an observer of ITRI. We have a number of members in Germany. The Völkbund, for example, is very active also in the RFID area. And
how many people work for ADRI, and how does it finance itself?
It's very difficult to answer. ADRI has one hired staff in Brussels, our advocacy coordinator, who is present at the meetings at the European Parliament, meets with the Commission representatives and so on, and distributes the information to the member organizations or the representatives of the member organizations. And depending from member to member, the structures are very different. Some have employed staff, others are pure volunteer organizations that work in their spare time on these topics. So you can't really give a number on the people that work for ADRI, but one is sure that we work very distributed. We do not work only locally in Brussels at the office, but spread the work all over Europe and do it where members have time to do the work or are competent to do the work, of course. In terms of our funding, it's, as with all NGOs in Europe, a very difficult topic and very difficult to find sufficient funding. We do projects that get funded by the European Union, so we submit our proposals and sometimes we win one. Then we have gladly and generously a grant from the Open Society Institute, who help us a lot to establish our structures in Brussels and give us support with building the organization and getting more influential and have more impact in the process. And we have some smaller individual donors that now every now and then give us a few euros, which we are very grateful for, of course. And we are also thinking about taking money from companies, but there we have to be really strict on the conditions that we define for these donations, because it's very important not to get dependent from companies and to keep a good distance from them. And so we defined to have a maximum of 30% of our funding coming from these sources, where a single company may not give more than 7% of our annual budget. So we want to make sure to stay independent and not to get trapped in the financial necessities, so to say.
Yeah, that's a very good classical approach. So now we have a kind of idea about ADRI. Maybe you can tell us now something about the topics you deal with, especially over the course of the 8-9 years ADRI exists. What have been the things you're working on?
Well, one thing we are working on that is now very hot, and we deal with it, in fact, I think since ADRI was founded, maybe a year later or something like that, that is data retention, mandatory data retention of telecommunication traffic data, so who communicated with whom at which time and at which location. That's is there is a directive from the European Union directive that obliges member states and providers to store this data for 6 months up to 2 years. And we fight this directive actively since, I think, 2003 or 2004, and also collected, I think, 50,000 signatures in 2005 that we handed over to the European Parliament and asked them not to sign off the directive. But unfortunately, we didn't succeed with this. Now we have the national implementations of this directive in some member states, or in most member states of the European Union, but still fight it. And actually, there was just today an evaluation report by the European Commission published on the directive, which we also counted. Yesterday we published our shadow report on the directive, where we had, I think, 30 pages on why we think that the directive completely failed, because it achieved none of its goals, but only limited the individual freedoms and fundamental rights of the citizens and all inhabitants of the European Union.
So maybe let's go into the shadow report. Why did you make a shadow report just one day before the Commission released the official report on that?
Well, we wanted to make sure that there is also our view represented in the public, and I think we already saw what the Commission was doing, because they sent questionnaires to the member states, they collected the answers, which became public, and from the answers it was already clear that what the Commission will come up with could never be a balanced view on data retention as it stands, because first of all, the Commission only asked those member states to provide reports that implemented the directive, which means that they cannot have a view on how how crimes developed in all of all European countries, and to compare how did crimes the crime rate develop in countries with data retention and how does it develop in countries without data retention, which would have enabled the Commission to see if there is a significant difference between these countries and to see if data retention actually has an effect. But the Commission decided to only ask those countries for input that implemented the directive, so it was not possible to even get this insight. And this is a complete flaw or a severe flaw of this evaluation, for example.
And when we look at Germany, I mean, they had an implementation of data retention for, I think it was 1.5 years. Mm-hmm. And the data which was created there didn't show a significant drop in crime solvings.
Right, and their data was not included in the evaluation of the Commission. So the Commission completely blacked out these developments and just used data that came from member states where data retention is still in force. And so it was not possible to get any insight. And the next step is that the member states didn't really provide statistical data. They provided anecdotes on, oh yes, this was this wonderful big case where we had such a success with the data from data retention, but this is not statistical data. This is not a scientific approach on how to evaluate something, but this is storytelling and telling anecdotes, but not a sincere and thorough evaluation of a political measure.
Now, I'm the optimistic European citizen. Why is this? Why don't they create a report which tries to be more objective on this subject?
Well, one of the problems is that the Commission already knew the results of the evaluation before they did the evaluation. Already in December last year, the competent commissioner, Mrs. Malmström, said at a conference, data retention here is here to stay. And at this moment, she did not have an evaluation report. It took her several more months to create this report and to finally come to a result. result of her evaluation, but she knew already before that data retention is here to stay. So this is a simple political process, but not a neutral evaluation. That is what we want to have, and that's why we published our shadow report.
Mm. And now I'd like to hit on this, on the subject of reasoning. Why is this law in existence in the first place? Who was there, who is the stakeholder of this, who will profit from such a piece of legislation?
That's a very good question, because there's one remarkable thing also in the evaluation report of the Commission. On the one hand, the Commission writes that there was a kind of alert in Europe when we had the two terrorist attacks in Madrid and in London, and therefore the Commission felt, or the European institutions rather, felt that they need some measure to counter this. And that's the reason that the Commission now gives why this directive was implemented in the first place. But on the other hand, in the same report, the Commission complains that member states were slow with implementing it. So that's one thing that I do not really understand. When there was a state of alert and the member states forced to have this directive, why didn't they implement it afterwards when they had it and when they had the possibility to counter terrorism? And that's an unsolved question, that there is no answer to it. What is not surprising, but what is common, I think, in all member states in the European Union, that there is one industry that heavily demands to get access to this retained data. And this is the copyright industry, so music industry, all these people that want to defend their business models from the last century and try to get some evil doers to pay their royalties to the
copyright mafia.
If you like to put it like that.
Now, just for a moment, try to follow this argumentation that we have this piece of legislation which came to being after terroristical attacks in Europe, which were nothing common, nothing which Europe has a big history with, at least in my political recognition. There isn't a long history of terroristical attacks in Europe. And also when you look at it from the other way, why is criminal statistic the way to prove or disprove something which should be a counter-terrorist measurement? We see this boundary from an extreme situation in a society when you have people from the outside who want to use weapons of mass destruction or whatever, and you couldn't establish this fear over a long period of time. I think now in Europe, when you have the terrorist argument, you won't go through in a public discourse, because we are over that in a way. You see in Germany and now also in Austria partly that it is the argument of child pornography which they use to make some kind of reasoning why we need this strong measurement. Mm-hmm. And can you draw a timeline when they came up with this argument of child pornography prevention?
Child pornography is always present in the discussion. It just was covered by terrorism when terrorism was more present in the public. But child pornography and also the Nazi propaganda was always around in the discussions. So it's always, you can be sure, if there is no argument to do something, then then you will hear child pornography and Nazis. But regarding to terrorism, if you look at the European crime statistics, then there are two hotspots for terrorism in Europe. The one is the Basque region in Spain, and the other is Corsica in France. These are territorial conflicts where there is some independence movement, and there are the problems with terrorism in Europe. There is more or less no other kind of terrorism in Europe. If you look at the statistics that are provided by the Europol, so by the European police organization. And so these are regional conflicts. They need a political solution. You can't solve these things with law enforcement, I think, because when you look to the Irish conflict that lasted for I don't know how many years, it was in the end a political solution that solved the problem. And that's the same is true for the other two regions. Therefore, I don't think that state retention will bring us anywhere. What's more, there is no reason to implement data retention in Austria, or let's say in Romania, to solve a regional conflict in Spain. These are on very different points geographical points in Europe. And so I think, yeah, it's an argument, but it's proven that the data is not useful, because also in the evaluation report from the Commission, you clearly see the data that is used is, or at least most of this data, is not older than 3 months, which means that this old data would be available anyway, because this is the time that the telecom providers need to do their invoicing. And for this period, they are allowed to store the data. And if the data is legally stored at the provider, police and law enforcement institutions also can access the data, provided they get an approval by a judge or something like that. So data retention, even for this purpose, where it's mostly used, is useless, because nobody needs the data after 3 months, or hardly, it is hardly needed.
And now, when we look at the present situation, what will happen? I mean, is it just the report which was just published in your shadow report, which was released one day before, are you only covering a process which is on the tracks and which will happen? Do we have to face the fact that we will have data retention in Europe, or do you see a realistic chance that we can still avoid this law?
No, we don't have to accept anything. We are now at the beginning of a new discussion about data retention, and it's now exactly the time to see if there is a strong belief in Europe that this is a measure that is actually needed, because there is the test of the fundamental test of the European Declaration for Fundamental Rights that explicitly says that you are only allowed to limit the right to privacy and to communication if this measure is necessary in a democratic society. And it's exactly this test that needs now to be evaluated. And my opinion and our opinion is that this piece of legislation does not pass this test. And that's the same what the European Data Protection Supervisor says. He said that data retention is the most invasive piece of legislation that was ever introduced in Europe in terms of invasion to the privacy and data protection. And that's not only us, that's not only the data protection supervisors, there are a lot of people, of organizations out there that have this opinion. And law enforcement still fails to give a proof that this is a necessary measure. And so we are at the beginning of a new discussion about data retention, where new arguments need to be presented to prove that this is necessary. And if it is not necessary, then it has to be removed.
It feels so logical when we talk between us about this topic, but what kind of impression can you give us from your work in Brussels? When you talk with people, how do they feel? Just the average European MP, or the people you have to convince, you know?
Well, it always depends whom you ask. Of course, the the feel for the need or not need for data retention heavily depends, of course, on the political belief of the person. So if you will get a different answer when you ask a green than when you ask a conservative, of course. And therefore, it's the question of good arguments in most cases, but also of political will to get to a result. And of course, if you have good and sound arguments, it's difficult to ignore them. And that's what we try to have, good arguments and to being convincing. Therefore it's important to be there in Brussels, to talk to MEPs, to talk to commission staff, to be present at discussions in Brussels, to give input to consultations, to public consultations and so on, and to raise your voice and to give input.
Can you give us some kind of impression from the other stakeholders who are present in Brussels, some lobbying organizations of the content mafia or maybe police organizations? I could also imagine that they would lobby for such a measurement in their hands.
Well, of course, all kinds of stakeholders are involved in this process. This starts from some companies that are rich enough to have paid staff there to do only lobbying in the European institutions. These are lobby companies that work for various clients, for example, to represent on specific topics different stakeholders or different clients of them. And there are consumer organizations that are present, but that's very, very few. And of course, large multinationals like Google, Microsoft, etc., they are all there, of course, with several persons and are involved in many discussions at the same time. So it's a bit difficult to cover all these topics, especially now we are already getting very close to our limits to be able to cover all these topics that are now on the agenda. We have to talk about data retention, about data protection, about web blocking. We have the ACTA, of course, as a big topic that we need to work on, and so on. So there are a lot of topics that we need to cover simultaneously, and so it's very, very difficult already for us to do the work, and that's why we need additional funding to be able to cover it better. But in general, well, how does it work? We meet people, we make contacts to MEPs, we make contacts to commission staff, we attend the meetings that are publicly available where we can get in, and we are in the parliament to visit, to watch and be at some consultations and so on. And it's a lot of contacting people, but it's also a lot of doing research on putting arguments together, of writing papers and so on. So it's very diverse.
And when you look now at Brussels from a realistic perspective, do you feel like you are David fighting Goliath, and you are one of a few civil rights organizations facing a huge European organization, huge European government, and many lobbyists which have a lot of money to work professional with a lot of staff in Brussels? Can you give us some realistic perspective from your time in Brussels?
Well, I think there is no clear line. On this side are we, and on the other side are the others, because you always try to build coalitions. You for every topic you need to find partners that support your views and that go the same direction. And then you have to look, okay, how can I work with them, and how can we together in for this topic have the most impact have the most impact. And so it's not a strict set of who the combatants are. This varies. Sometimes other lobbyists, or sometimes some lobbyists are our partners for a certain topic, and we are on completely different side on other things. So it's also about coalition building and having the ability to always talk to each other. That's very important, to have always a level where you can easily talk to each other, even if you have different opinions. And that's, I think, the most valuable thing in this work.
Could you give us some examples about coalition partners when it comes to data retention, or maybe something like net neutrality?
Well, there is a number of organizations that do not like data retention. ISPs, for example, service providers do not like it. Also in France, for example, I think Microsoft and Google together went to the court to fight some aspects of the national law there. And so it's it can be from large multinational companies to the consumer groups to I don't know
So and what limits your work is maybe just the amount of people you have who volunteer to be in Brussels and talk with people, really build up network and have insights into topics? Or is it the resources in terms of finances you need to, I don't know, be invited to certain things, or to publish or to do research and provide data?
It goes hand in hand, of course. Most of the money that we need is for additional staff, because we need to balance work better, and we need to be able to attend more meetings and to work on more things simultaneously. And this is, of course, the most expensive things. It's also always costs for staff that are extremely expensive. But on the other hand, it's as well the office space. It's about being able to fly to Brussels or to Strasbourg and to attend meetings there and so on. Alone for Vienna to Brussels, it costs, I think, €450 for one visit. So if I have to go often, this gets really expensive, at least for my budget.
You have to cover all this from your private bucket, or do you?
No, it depends. In the expert group that I mentioned before, where on the RFID and privacy topic, this was an official expert group of the European Commission, and for that the European Commission covers the travel costs. So at least I do not have to cover the flights, but still my time is unpaid. And this is, of course, time that I cannot sell to my customers, and that hurts.
So what would solve this problem? Because I think in Europe it's particularly that everything happens in Brussels, or maybe some things also in Strasbourg. But for most people in Europe, these are areas where you can just go. It's not like your capital city, where you can go and talk with MPs. So would you wish for something like a refund for people who want to actively take part in this European process of democracy and opinion building?
Yeah, I think in the contrary to the US, we do not have a culture of giving donations, for example, to building funds that support a certain topic. And that makes it very difficult for NGOs to survive, because these are in the US the big resources of funding. There is a culture that people give money to the organization they think they make good work. And this culture is not so present in Europe, and this is one point, I think, which makes it difficult. And on the other hand, also our tax systems are very complicated. It's not given that in every country you can deduct donations from your tax bill. In some countries this is possible. In Austria, for example, you need to be on a very very limited list to get this status. We, for example, cannot get on this list because we do not fulfill the criteria. We need to deal with environment or with social welfare or something like that to get this status. And therefore, yeah, it's a little bit difficult, and I think we need to change this culture. We need to recognize that we need to engage our personally in defending of our rights, because there is nobody who will do this for us. And then I think we will be able to change something, and that's the important thing to learn. You can go out there, you can go to Brussels, and you can change something. This is possible, and of course it's not something easy to do, but it's doable. And the more often you do it, the easier it gets, and the more people you do it, the easier it gets. And I think this is a change of culture that we need, and yeah.
Maybe we come to another topic, one very important one in my opinion, and that's net neutrality. I don't know, have you worked on that? Have you experienced something in the European discussion about when it comes to things like quality of service up to non-discriminative packet routing and all these things?
I have not worked on it personally, but I know the discussion was.
And can you give some impression? Is it on the agenda somewhere, or?
Yes, of course, it is on the agenda, and it is actively discussed. One of the arguments that is often presented by industry representatives is that they do not understand why, for example, Google causes such a lot of traffic while not paying for this traffic to them. And I think the relatively easy answer to this point is that Google pays for this traffic. So the problem is not that Google is not paying and is having a free ride. But the contrary, I'm sure they pay a lot. The problem is that the distribution of what Google pays is obviously not good enough. If this money doesn't arrive at the carrier that serves my internet access, so then there is something wrong with the distribution, and they need to change the kind of how they do business with each other, one carrier, one service provider with the other. And that's not something for me to do. I do not have to pay more because I already pay my internet access, as well as if I run a service on the internet or a website or whatever, then I pay my fees there as well. And if this is too cheap, well, okay, then they have to raise the prices, but they don't have to interfere in my traffic.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, right now we have the situation that providers get money from both ends, from the client who is sending a request to a server, and also from the server housing where the person also has to pay for the internet access there. Mm-hmm. And I think in the case of Google, it is now a matter of fact that they get most of their traffic over peering. So Google themselves own a lot of bandwidth, and they just pair with other providers, so there are equal amounts of traffic shared between them, and you do not pay for, I don't know, I route a few terabytes over your network, and therefore you give me this X amount of euros. I think it's quite remarkable when we think back about this deal Google made with Verizon, where they basically put a statement up about net neutrality being something which is okay for cable internet, but in mobile internet they basically want to find other ways of how to deal with all that. And the reason why I'm bringing that up is because I think that's a really big topic for the future, and it maybe will sum up all the other things we are discussing right now when it comes to data retention or when it comes to censorship in the internet, filtering. It is basically all the same if our current paradigm
of the internet as we know it, and as it's hard to think otherwise, because that's how we are used to deal with the internet. But this is not something which is a natural law or something. It can easily be changed, and there are people who have interests in changing these basic fundamentals of an equal internet. And so I wonder if IDRI understands itself also as a kind of, I don't know, lobbying in a wider sense of what these digital rights in Europe will look like in 5 years' time or 10 years' time. Do you look ahead in this sense?
Yes, of course, because one of the fundamental things of the internet is that based on its openness and based on the standards that that are available, the open standards that are available to everybody, it was possible to build this internet. If you had closed it, if you had two or three companies that decided on what you are allowed to do and what not, we would not have an internet today. And this is one of the fundamental parts of the future of the internet, to maintain this openness and to maintain this ability for everybody to do something with it. Because this enables the programmer in the rural area as well as the programmer in the large city to do the same thing, and they can have the same chances to do their work and do their business and to be creative and to add to the common good, which they do. And this is therefore very important, that the traffic from the small block, for example, doesn't get limited, because this small block might have the potential to be the next big service on the internet and to provide very important things for all of us. And therefore, it's so important to have it, to have equal chances. This is one of the most important achievements of the internet, I think.
We again are hitting the point of creativity, and if you have an economic or legal system which tries to have sharp boundaries within this creativity, you know, either may it be copyright, which forbids you to make a mashup of a certain video or use a piece of music for your next creation, or is it a limitation for your startup that you have to pay a huge amount of money to be able to serve to your clients in the same speed as the big companies can do it? And when we look at Europe, we have this phenomenon of the pirate party. And in my opinion, at least, I see in some national implementations of them that they are really trying to give this new digital rights movement a voice. Have you dealt with them on a European level? How competent do you think they are on a European level? Not speaking about Austria.
I don't know too much about the Pirate Party, I have to admit. That's my fault, so this is not a judgment of what they do, but the few things that I've seen from them seemed good to me. But as I said, I don't know all the details what they do, but yeah.
If one of our listeners wants to keep up with the things that go on in Brussels, are there any information resources which you could suggest for listeners that they, I don't know, follow the discussion in Europe, that they get some insights in how this European system works? I don't know if these are blogs or if you could name specific persons to follow.
That's easy for me. You can subscribe to our bi-weekly newsletter, the IDRIgram, which we published since 2003, where we cover more or less all the topics that we are, well, not more or less, but where we cover all the topics that we work on. We have, I think, currently some 6,000 subscribers or something like that, so it seems people like us. And we present our work, but not only our work, but also what's happening in the topics that we work on, because we think it's important to also
have a good information resource to see what is the, in the data protection field, what is in various other fields. And so we try to cover these. We have always one opinion piece in the newsletter, but the rest we try to keep more to the facts and have it in a news style. Then, of course, you can follow us on Twitter. It's edwi_org. And visit our website and so on. So just get in contact with us if you have questions. And
I'll definitely link to all of these. And what kind of support do you need? Do you need volunteers? Do you need money? Do you need experts in certain fields?
We can use any expertise that we can get, of course. If someone wants to contribute, wants to help us analyze things, wants to help us work on opinion pieces, on input papers for consultations and so on, just get in contact with us, help us. We always have work to do. And of course, we always need money, and take that information on how to give us money is on our website. And we would be grateful to get donations, of course.
Maybe you could offer something like our 5 best donors get a tour through Brussels. We had an activity like that for bloggers in Austria. I think it was about a Green Party. I don't know who exactly it was. No, it was the European Commission, I think. And they showed them around, showed them the buildings in Brussels and had a tour, met with a few MPs. And because I still see this big problem of intransparency in Europe, the lack of information. There is no real European civil society or European media. It's all still on a very national level.
Yeah, that's also something that we experienced. We made, it was I think in February last year, we made an event in Brussels in the European Parliament, where we managed to get a room and we made a meeting of our own activists, so the people that work with our member organizations, and we got them to Brussels and had some contacts in the European Parliament, but also from the Commission and from the Council that came to present to them how the legislative process in Brussels works. So they get first-hand information on how these things work. And we took one legislative piece as an example, and it was explained to them how all this went, that we finally were successful on that. And I think this was very important for the activists as well, because then it makes a difference if you sit at home and think, okay, now this will feed in the parliament, I know that, but it's a difference to be there and then to sit there with the parliamentarian and talk to him and hear from the parliamentarian what his impression of the things that we did was and how it was received and so on and how it influenced his process. And so that's really a very important thing.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. Now, as we come to the end of the show, I think we should go back or go down to Austria, and maybe you can tell our listeners something as your function as a member of the working group on data retention in Austria. What's the current status in Austria when it comes to data retention?
Well, we have a draft law that is already in parliament and passed already the two competent committees, the technology committee and the justice committee, and the Austrian parliament is about to decide on this draft law end of April, so that's next week. And we do try our best here in Austria to give them as much information that data retention is not necessary. That's why I also yesterday sent an open letter to all parliamentarians in Austria with our shadow report on the data retention directive. And there are also a lot of other activities where activists contact people to do something against data retention. And most importantly, on 21st of April, there are two demonstrations planned, in one in Linz and one in Graz. So everybody in Austria, please go there, show up and show your protest, show that you do not like to be surveilled on, and that you do not want your data to be stored. That's important. Exercise your rights. That's one of the most important things that you can do.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And it is somehow it's strange, isn't it? Because I now have the feeling that it's sometimes easier to fight laws like that on a European level than it is on an Austrian level.
Of course it is. Of course it is. That's why we decided to establish European digital rights, because when the directive is in place, there is not much chance to change something. You can change within the borders of the directive if you get a stronger implementation or a weaker one. But the fact that the directive needs to be implemented will not go away. And that's the reason why we need to fight all these things in Brussels at the European institutions, so that such directives are not established in the first place. Because then we have all these we avoid all these problems. And as I said, we started, I think, in 2003 or 2004 with the fight against data retention. That's a very long time. And would we have been successful then, all the rest with constitutional courts and I don't know what would not have been necessary. And that's a lot of power that goes in there, and that's a lot of wasted time, simply, if you can manage to get it right in the first place.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you have to deal with the European level and you have to talk with people there, because there also decisions are made. But at the end, Europe is not some faraway country. We have our own MPs there. We have our own ministers talking with other European ministers, and their decisions get made. And what I meant was also that I often have the quite disappointing feeling that in Austria we are lacking a basic civil society, especially when it comes to topics of digital civil rights, that we don't see this uprising like you had in Germany, where people go to the streets, where they have an argument online and then groups formate, and it seems much slower and much more, I don't know, uninterested in Austria.
Yes, we are kind of, let's say, satisfied, I think, satisfied with the social partnership, the so-called, where we have the representatives for commerce, and we have the representatives for the workers, not only the unions but also Arbeiterkammer, and these do these things for us. We do not care, we do not need to care much about the things, because there is two institutions that do all this work for us, and so we are not used to get engaged ourselves. And also the unions have the problem that to find supporters, because they are too much institutionalized already. And of course, your freedoms do not come from sitting at home and waiting that they come. We need to go out, and that's one of the most important things. And I think that we are at a good point in the moment, because we now build the working group on data retention, for example. And that's already how it started in Germany. We are some years later, but okay. But we are doing the right things now. We are making contacts with each other, we are meeting, we are planning demonstrations, and so we start to exercise our rights, and we should not stop with that, and we must not stop with that. We need to go on, and we need to exercise all our rights, not only our protest against data retention, but all the things that we think are important, because otherwise we will not be represented.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, we need this two-layer strategy, at least two layers, where we start European-wise, where we make our contribution to this European process, but also nationally, I think much more needs to be done. And the working group on data retention in Germany, for example, could draw a lot of resources from the KS Computer Club. And also in France, you have La Quadrature du Net, which is basic, think tank or pool of resources where people can connect. And they also have this, much eager protest culture. It seems to me that there you have more people who are willing to engage in this, and it is an optimistic thing.
I disagree because the difference is they started earlier, and therefore they are now visible. And everything that is visible is from our perspective stronger, because they already made it to get a position so they can be seen, that we can see them, and therefore they must be powerful. That's the reception. But how did they get there? There were a few people that met in a room and they said, we do something. And then they started to do something and they were successful. Or maybe they were not successful, but they got the interest of others. And then they did the next thing, and so on. But we need to start at a point, and the point is now, and that's good, I think. But one of the most important things I think we need to do is to keep an eye on our own politicians. Because how comes that almost nobody in Austria knows what our governments, our ministers do in the European Council in Brussels, which positions they take there for us? And I would be very interested in getting this information, and so we should go to them and demand or ask them to give us this information. Because I really would like to know which position the Austrian government will, for example, have in the data retention debate or in the web blocking debate, because these topics are currently discussed there. And I really would like to know what they do. And if I do not like what they do, then I would like to be able to protest against it. And because they are representing us, they are elected by us, so we should also be able to get the information what is going on. And that's one of the weak points of the European system, that council meetings are secret. They only give the information that they feel they would like to give us. And I think that's one of the bigger transparency problem in Europe. The parliament is, on the other hand, very transparent, where all the meetings, even of the committees, are public and are streamed to the web, so everybody in Europe can all over the world can view these debates and can take part. And can contact his or her member of the parliament or every member of the parliament and get in contact with them and tell them what they think about the things that they do there. And the same is, of course, true for the Austrian parliament. We need to get transparency there. We need to get information what topics they are discussing and who takes which positions. And this is the right that we need to claim, I think.
There was this... maybe too Austrian now, but there was a project which is very famous in Germany. It's called Abgeordnetenwatch, and they want to implement that in Austria. Again, we are not in the far ahead. We are more a lazy country which adapts things years after the others did. But Mein Abgeordneter, it is called, and I will link on that. And it's perfectly right what you said. Transparency is the one thing where you have a bridge between all these digital topics and basic democracy, and every modern state should have these values in the constitution and very, very bold letters.
And La Quadrature du Net had a wonderful example on how helpful this is. They have a list on which member of the European Parliament voted on the dossiers that were important for La Quadrature du Net. So they have the voting results. They know exactly this member of the Parliament was pro or against this certain piece of legislation that was important to us. And this also helps you to make your decision at the next elections, because then you can see, okay, who are the persons that are in favor of the things that I feel are important. And that's a piece of an important, very important piece of democracy, to have this this transparency and to get the information to do better decisions maybe the next time.
Mm-hmm. You remember me of Julian Assange saying that people need the information to make informed decisions.
Right, exactly.
Europe leaks, maybe, yeah. Good, then Andreas, I thank you for being here and for giving us some insight from your work in Brussels.
Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, and I wish you all the best for all your efforts there. And yeah, keep us informed. Maybe we will have another discussion in a few months' time. And for now, that is it for today from Talking Anthropology. As always, you can comment on my site, on talkingantropology.com. And there is also a Flatter button. And yeah, we would like to have some better audio equipment. Maybe that's also in your interest. And yeah, thank you for listening and hear you soon.
Bye-bye.